Good morning. Up right now on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host for this morning, and I'm joined in the studio by my producer, Morgan Geyer, who's keeping everything running smoothly. We're here live every Saturday morning between 9 and 10, and our show deals with all matters of the mind and heart, including mental health, stress, life transitions, parenting, sexuality, spirituality, and much more. Please join us this morning by visiting our Facebook page and posting a message there. It's the Mind and Heart Show on your Facebook feed. You can send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC or email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. If you're unable to be with us the full hour this morning, you can check us out starting on Monday on CVillePodcast.com. That's CVILLE podcast, one word, CVillePodcast.com. So this morning, we have a guest scheduled. A colleague from Northern Virginia was going to call in and talk about workplace violence and mass shootings. Right now, we're having some phone glitches, so I'm going to just talk about some of this in general terms while we try to get the phones working so that we can talk to my colleague in Northern Virginia. So this issue, certainly with San Bernardino more recently, has been all over the front page. Since 2006, there have been 200 mass killings in the United States. So in the last 9 years, there have been 200 mass killings in the U.S. And the FBI defines a mass killing as four or more victims per shooting. So that's an awful lot of mass killings, and it's become increasingly apparent that we have a real problem. If you look at the trends historically, that's a real uptick going back 30 years, 40 years, whatever. And so roughly we're talking about one mass shooting every 2 weeks, so much so that I worry a little bit about folks getting complacent about it, or just immune to the bad news. So that's going to be our topic today. Hopefully we'll get our phones up and going and get our caller in here, our guest in here on the phone, and we'll go from there. So let's talk a little bit in general terms about some of these mass shootings, and then hopefully we'll be able to get the phone working and get my guest on the line, and then we can get her perspective, because she's done a tremendous amount of work in this area and can really help us shed some light on the topic. And so, as I was saying, since 2006, we've had 200 mass killings in the U.S., defined as four or more victims, and that's approximately one every 2 weeks. And 1% of all of these killings nationwide involve terrorism, and the vast majority of them do not involve terrorism as we've defined it, as someone from a radical or terrorist group shooting folks. San Bernardino was certainly an example of a terrorist attack, but they represent the significant minority of such attacks. And many of the others are the result of family conflict, workplace conflict, disgruntled employees, some mental illness, although that gets overstated, I think, but not terrorism. So we see this massive response to the threat of terrorism when it's really quite low in terms of the incidence of these shootings on U.S. soil. You would not know that by watching CNN or Fox, but the reality is that it's a very, very small number. We end up indicting an entire group of folks because of these rare shootings, and that's certainly something that's been current in the news the last week or two. So looking at some other statistics, I found this interesting. From 1982 through 2013, which was the last year in which these statistics were kept, the breakdown in terms of shooters in these mass killings were of the ones that occurred during that time period, 44 of the perpetrators were white, Caucasian, 11 were African American, 6 were Asian, 4 were Latino, and 1 was Native American. So it's clearly still these mass shootings are predominantly a white male phenomenon. And if you notice those numbers, though, those numbers for each category that I just gave, there were none for folks of Arab descent. The gender breakdown is pretty obvious in terms of these mass killings. It's something like 97% of these are committed by men, by males, and only 3% by females. So we have this picture emerging of largely white male perpetrators in the event of these mass shootings. And if you think Sandy Hook School, the theater in Colorado, others that aren't coming to mind, but in each case, those were white perpetrators. We have our technical ace here in the studio with us now, Jeff Leonard, who is hopefully going to get us up and running on the phones so we can talk to our guest and get some perspective from her to continue the discussion. That was going to be the bulk of the show today, so hopefully we can get that going. If not, you'll just have to listen to me and perhaps send me questions online, or you won't be able to call into the studio. So if you want to jump into this discussion, please visit our Facebook page, which is the Mind and Heart Show. You can also send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC. You can email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. So please feel free to do that. We'd love to hear from you and get your perspective. The only ground rule is that we maintain civility during any discussion. So this can be a hot topic. This can be a topic about which people can get fairly emotional, but we just want to maintain civility if we hear from you in terms of any discussion we have this morning. So thinking further about this while we still try to get our phones fixed, the question of mental illness has certainly, given my professional background as a clinical and forensic psychologist, has been one that's always on the forefront of these shootings. The research suggests that since 1970, about 60% of the perpetrators of mass shootings did display some symptoms of mental illness, such as paranoia, delusions, depression, and so forth, before committing their crimes. James Holmes, who was the shooter in the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting, at the time of the shooting was in treatment with a psychiatrist who specialized in the treatment of schizophrenia, which is a serious psychotic disorder. Jared Loughner, the shooter in the Congressman Giffords shooting out in Arizona, was also someone that had a history of struggling with his emotions and with interpersonal relationships during much of his life. Now, I do worry about the extent to which we start blaming the mentally ill for these shootings. That being said, it's very doubtful that any of us who aren't suffering from significant mental illness would go shoot up a movie theater or an elementary school. So it's certainly in the mix. That often gets distinguished from the terrorist-motivated shootings where it's based upon some radical ideology. Now, I would argue that folks that are susceptible to the message of the jihadist, of the terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, are themselves suffering from some significant deficit in their life, or they wouldn't be attracted to those messages. They would not be attracted to the recruitment that goes on with some of these radical organizations. What that is, it's probably despair, it's probably depression, it's probably hopelessness, but they're not people that are functioning well and having a great life. But I'm always a little concerned about over attributing these incidents to terrorism. So bear with me just a minute. I think we've got our phones working. I'm going to call my guest, and we will continue the discussion. So let's see if we can get her on the line. Hello, you there?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
You're very fuzzy, and okay. I have music in the background.
Okay, we're gonna fade out the music. And
your voice is almost, I can almost not understand what you're saying.
Okay.
It's really, really distorted.
Distorted. Is it too low?
No, it sounds like you're talking through a CB radio. It's really, really fuzzy.
Okay, let me see what we can do here. She says it's like we're talking through a CB radio. Is there any way to clear that up in terms of what's going to her? Are you still there?
Bad, Jeff.
Is that any better?
Nope.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it. Can you hear us okay or not, Mary?
I can hear you, but there's so much distortion, but I'm just letting you know that. So
okay.
I don't know what's going to come across the air, but...
Well, I think you're coming across pretty smoothly. So if you can hear my questions, we'll try to get some of this in if that works for you.
Yeah, I'm a little stressed because I don't know how. Okay, go ahead.
So anyway, I want to let everyone know that my guest this morning, and we apologize for the technical difficulties, is a colleague, Mary Vandeventer, who is a clinical social worker in Northern Virginia. And she has done a lot of work with treating trauma, especially folks that have been involved in crisis situations, mass shootings, and so forth. Mary, would you just start by letting our listeners know a little bit about your background in terms of how you got to this business and sort of what was your path as a professional?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Jeff. By education, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I've been in private practice in Alexandria, Virginia, since about 1987.
Okay.
I spent my first several years working with adults suffering from severe mental illness in community mental health settings. But during the years I've been in private practice, I've developed several subspecialties in trauma, addiction, couples family therapy, domestic violence, sexual assault, and pretty much anything that walks through the door.
Okay. And I know you stay very busy up there. Tell us a little bit about, are those your primary specialties that you just mentioned, substance abuse, trauma?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to ask you, I know one situation that we had talked about some time ago was there was a shooting at the Navy Yard in D.C., and you were involved with dealing with some of the aftermath of that. Could you just bring everybody up to speed on what happened that day and then your role coming in to deal with the survivors of that incident?
Sure. Well, first let me say that I'm specialized in particular modality called critical incident stress debriefing.
Okay.
And I've been doing that for 20 plus years. It's a small group process that's been used since the mid-70s, actually was developed for paramedics and firefighters and police who had, were distressed by exposure to, you know, something particularly gruesome. So I was trained in this method, and eventually this has been made available through employee assistance programs. So
okay.
I was called in the day after the shooting, and there was a contracted employee that came in, brought a gun to work with him, and shot 12 people, killed 12 people, and wounded several others. So I was called in to, you know, really administer what I would call psychological first aid and help management sort of figure out a plan going forward about how to care for the folks that have been impacted by this.
Okay. And I'm guessing if you're in a situation like that where you survive but you've witnessed it, that your whole worldview changes in terms of thinking that we live in a relatively safe world to thinking that just the contrary.
Oh yeah, I mean it really changes your sense of safety, and you know, most people will for several weeks feel quite ungrounded, you know, and unsafe in their world. So absolutely.
Yeah. And is there a typical symptom presentation from those folks that you see, or does it vary all over the map?
No, I think typically what you're going to see initially is shock, of course, and disbelief, you know, the sense of unreality of what's happened. And from that you see, the symptoms that I tend to see initially have to do with disruption in normal daily routine, difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating, you know, doing sort of normal everyday tasks become very challenging because the brain is trying to make sense of what happened.
Right.
It's trying to process what happened. But everybody reacts very differently to trauma. I think that folks that have had trauma in their background previous to an incident like the Navy Yard shooting would struggle in a different way, because that prior trauma will often be unearthed.
Okay.
The brain sort of doesn't know the difference between what's happening today and what happened 15 years ago. So they might find themselves struggling in a different way than their coworkers without even realizing that this prior event had influenced them. So I'm part of my job is to really look out for people who are more fragile in that sense, who are at higher risk for developing something like post-traumatic stress.
Okay. But that's not to say that folks that had no prior history of trauma would not themselves also be adversely impacted by the incident.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, this is when we talk about the Navy Yard shooting. I was involved with that group for 18 months, which is really it's a long time.
Yeah.
Most of these incidents, I am in and out in 2 days.
Okay. So what interested you going back some years in this area, this specific model of treatment? Because I know how critically important it is, and I know how the science of critical incident debriefing has really evolved. But what drew you to this particular type of intervention in your career?
Oh, interesting question.
Put you on the spot.
Yes. Well, I started a private practice part-time, and I think it was about 1994, I took a part-time job with the Department of the Navy at a facility in Arlington, Virginia. And my first day of work, there had been a shooting 2 days prior.
Good golly.
In one of the offices. They were spread all throughout a particular area in Arlington, this unit of the Department of Navy. And so when I arrived, my new boss greeted me in the lobby saying, "I'm sorry, your orientation has been suspended for a couple of weeks. We've scheduled you to meet with four different groups today that impacted by the shooting. So your first group starts in 20 minutes. I'll walk you over there." But for the next 3 weeks, I worked alongside an excellent critical incident specialist from the Arlington County Police Department. And we were together, you know, constantly for the next 3 weeks.
Okay.
And then I followed the victims, of course, for the next couple of years. And then I subsequently received training and certification in critical incident debriefing through the Washington Fire and Rescue Department. So then I went into full-time practice 2 years after that, and I've conducted probably about 500 debriefings since then.
Golly, and that is such important work, just so the listeners understand how huge this is in terms of helping people get through one of these crises and then restabilize their lives. I'm guessing, Mary, that if a loved one of mine is a victim of one of these shootings, that I myself could suffer some fairly traumatic response to the horror of that sort of loss. Is that something you ever see or get involved with as well?
With the families?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, because the families, of course, they haven't experienced it. They don't quite know what to do. They get frustrated after a period of time. It's sort of like the compassion runs out. People who have experienced this kind of trauma tend to be symptomatic for a while and tend to isolate. They're trying to process what happened to them, and so the family members feel very disconnected from them. So it's a very, if I can work with family members, I'm always happy to do that. I don't always have that opportunity.
Okay.
But how to help them be with people who have experienced severe trauma is very tricky business.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, you do see some families sort of trying to turn it towards some good by maybe starting an organization or, doing something to memorialize their loved one. And I'm assuming that can be part of a healthy response to this sort of horrific tragedy.
Absolutely. I think that, especially since 9/11, what we've seen is that people that go on to help other folks that have suffered similar traumas have really fared much better. So there's something about the altruism and taking what's happened to them and turning into something that positive for folks that have been through something similar has really made a huge difference in their resilience and in their bouncing back.
Yeah, I could only imagine that would be very important part of their healing. So,
yeah.
So what are some of the situations that a critical incident debriefing intervention would be appropriate? Is it typically a shooting situation, or might there be other situations where a person such as yourself would be called in?
Yeah, I'm called in for lots and lots of reasons. Shootings are, much, much more rare. I would say takeover bank robberies.
Oh, yeah.
I've worked with folks who have been in terrorist attacks overseas, fatalities from industrial accidents, homicide of a coworker, suicide, natural disasters. Worked with news teams coming back from Haiti after the earthquake there, plane crashes. So there's lots of reasons that they might bring us in, but it's basically that a work group has been destabilized by a trauma that they've either experienced themselves or in a secondary fashion because a coworker did.
Okay, that's fascinating. I guess I hadn't thought about the breadth of situations in which you might be called, but that certainly covers a lot of territory, and it just again speaks, I think, to the importance of this intervention. Is there a typical? That's not a fair question. Is there a sort of series of steps you go through, or do you have to adapt it to each situation and each in with regard to the uniqueness of that situation?
Well, yes. the long answer, it's like being in psychotherapy practice. Your first few years, you're running to the books, and you're right. going by the, you're using lots of different techniques and step by step. But you know, after 500 of these, you know, I have a nose that I go in and there really isn't a one size fits all for every situation. And having said that, you know, there is I am grounded in a basic format, so I often will come in and triage with management about, you know, where we need to start. And I believe very strongly that if we can get affected work groups together in a group situation first, that has the best outcome, meaning that if we can pull a group together, I can talk about what my expertise is, why I'm there, is to help them cope with what's happened and to help them stabilize and offer them some suggestions and some ideas about what they can expect over the next days and weeks. It's hugely important. Sometimes my hands get tied and I'm brought in and put in a room and people are told there's a counselor there. So the likelihood of their coming to see me is very small. So if I can meet folks, then there's sort of a storytelling process, meaning I might go around and ask people to share what their experience was, how they first heard about what happened, how they feel like it's impacted them.
And I guess those group settings can be pretty emotionally charged. I'm guessing that you know, those folks are really struggling at that time.
Yes. Yes, they can be, and I think it takes some clinical savvy to figure out how to manage that, you know, when to encourage it and when to try to temper it somewhat.
Yeah.
So there's a real dance that's going on. So I wouldn't call it a really cathartic experience, which can really, it's cathartic in the sense that I think that hearing one person say, this is how it impacted me, gives other people permission to be okay with how they're being impacted, because oftentimes people are feeling so isolated in their response and feeling quite crazy about how they're responding to it or how they're thinking about it. So it really universalizes people's experience by hearing other people talk about it.
To me, that seems so, so important. I mean, just the fact that I'm not alone, I'm not thinking I'm crazy because I'm having this reaction, or I can't sleep, or I'm hypervigilant. I mean, it must be so reassuring for folks to see the commonality that you just described.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's huge. Yeah. It's huge. And I often say, you know, when they bring me in and want to put me in a room just to see people individually, I say, if they don't meet me and understand that they're all going through this together, they're not going to come.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's and from, you know, I have to all sometimes sell that group process from a business perspective to management, because I say, you know, if you don't do this, it's at your own peril, because you'll start to see attrition. You'll see people quitting. You'll see people acting out by calling in sick.
Okay.
Or there'll be lots and lots of hanging around and talking because they're trying to work it out themselves.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, this is the Mind and Heart Show. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host. We're here every week from 9 to 10 a.m. We are 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Please join us. Feel free to get involved in the discussion. You can go to our Facebook page, Mind and Heart Show, and post a message. You can send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC, or you can email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. And my guest this morning is Mary Van Devanter, who is a clinical social worker in Fairfax and a colleague, someone who I have very high regard for in terms of her amazing abilities as a clinician. And she's talking to us this morning about the response to mass shootings, workplace incidents, trauma in the form of a horrific accident. There's a whole range of circumstances in which Mary would be called in to help the survivors of that incident move on with their lives and address the trauma from having having witnessed or been involved in. Mary, I'm guessing that if I'm the one under the desk that the shooter didn't get and there's others around me, do you ever see what I would call survivor guilt in the folks that survive?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That is... that's one of the first things that I encounter with people is feeling. In fact, I've had a couple of situations where one person actually threw themselves, shielded a person in order to spare them. I think we saw this in San Bernardino recently.
Right.
Where someone threw themselves on someone else and they were the ones that got killed. So you can imagine.
Oh my gosh.
The guilt someone might feel in that situation. So, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, it just must be a terrible burden for them to have to carry. And so do men and women respond differently? Do you see a gender difference in terms of the folks you deal with in the debriefings?
Great question. And I'm just, you know, it's just my little demographic here, but absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, women have so much more permission to talk about moods and struggling with emotions than males do. And so absolutely. But also, I would say, if we look at different ethnic groups and levels of education, it varies, really, really varies. So if I'm sitting in a very affluent busy law firm and I'm sitting with white male law partners, it's very, very different than if I'm sitting with a group of females that are human resources specialists. I mean, so it really, really varies. But I would say that as Caucasians, we are the frozen chosen.
Yeah, we certainly hear that. Yeah.
Yes. So and folks, some folks from other countries, their ability to express their emotions is very different than ours.
So you have to be able to sort of make adjustments in terms of cultural differences. You have to go in and get a read on who is in this group of survivors and then try. Because I'm thinking, for instance, that with law enforcement personnel, male and female, they can be or military for that matter, pretty tough nuts to crack in terms of talking about their feelings and so forth.
Yes, absolutely, and you know, with military, it's one thing because they're trained to see violence. So the way they hold this is very different. In fact, ironically, that first shooting in Arlington in 1994, there was a naval officer that I worked with during that period of time. He ended up being in the Navy Yard shooting 20 years later. Imagine that, you know, between one and the other, I've done 500 of these, and there he is. And, you know, he actually did quite well because this is something that he's trained to do. I don't know what other kind of help he got, but military folks in these kinds of situations react differently than civilians because civilians don't expect it. Having said that, there's also a wall, and the defenses are, you know, it's like, don't show emotion. It's really, really important not to do that, and
right.
And that makes sense. I mean, in terms of their training, it makes sense. I think over time, there's probably a huge impact with police are very, very difficult, and in fact, they're probably the most difficult groups that I ever work with, and they do much better with peer support.
Okay.
And actually, this process of CISD is often done with safety officials by peer support groups, people that are trained within the ranks.
Sort of one of their own.
Yes.
Okay. And does that, do you find that sort of gives them permission, if I'm a colleague in that setting, it's a little easier for them to open up than if you or I went in there?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And then there are, you know, there are some groups, when I work with what I would call industrial accidents and I go on construction sites, you know, or in IT situations, sometimes I'm walking in to a group and I have to really start with some humor. I ask them about the work they do. I join with them in that way, and actually I ease into the conversation very differently in a very informal way than I would with a different kind of office corporate work group.
Okay. Now, there's been a lot of talk recently in the media about if everybody at the Navy Yard or everybody at San Bernardino were armed, these things could be avoided. I guess my feeling is that people that are armed without a real knowledge of how to use firearms, it could just make the situation worse. Does that come up in any of your discussions where people say, golly, if we all had firearms, we could have prevented this? Do you have thoughts about that? I know it's a
it doesn't come up in discussions. I'm surprised that it doesn't, but it doesn't.
I'm surprised as well.
I'm very alarmed by hearing this. I was very alarmed to hear our own DC police chief Kathy Lanier say this recently, that if people had guns in these situations, they could protect themselves, and that it is a way of preventing getting killed in a mass shooting. Which to me is really, I don't know where she's coming from. Mm-hmm. Often when I'm working with police, they are very leery of people having guns in these situations because they're not trained to react when they're in that kind of fight or flight response.
Yeah, there was a recent segment, just comes to mind, on 60 Minutes, I think, where they took a bunch of handgun owners who had been really experienced on the shooting range. They shot two or three times a week. They'd been doing it for quite some time. And they put them in a situation with paintball pistols, basically. But unbeknownst to them, they were being set up. It was a classroom for someone to come in and start shooting. And to a person, every one of them froze or couldn't get the gun out of the holster or, you know, tripped or just freaked out. And the point of the whole segment was that police train to do this stuff all the time, and you think if you can go get a concealed carry permit and be effective in that situation, you're kidding yourself. Speaks to your point, that because under that kind of duress and that kind of stress, you know, our problem solving goes out the window. We're fight or flight, as you said, or freeze. And to watch these people literally freeze in their tracks while the perpetrator put four paintball stains on the front of their shirt, it was pretty sobering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you just flipping the switch a little bit, because I know you've thought about this. There's a lot of talk about, are all of these shooters mentally ill? I was actually talking about that earlier while we were trying to get the phones worked out. And you know, I think there are folks that feel like it's too easy just to say, well, they're mentally ill, that's why they did it. And I know we hadn't really planned to talk about that, but I just wondered off the top of your head if you had thoughts about that in general.
Well, this is being discussed right now. I mean, this is a very hot topic, of course. Right. In fact, one of my colleagues up here, Lisa Gold, who's a forensic psychiatrist, has written a book that's just been released on gun violence and mental illness. So, you know, the answer is not all of them.
Okay.
We have certainly seen that a number of them have had evidence of mental illness in terms of being diagnosed, you know, and I wouldn't say in treatment, but in terms of being diagnosed as having something like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, okay. Really only one or two that we know of. So not necessarily. You know, we're still really looking at this and analyzing this. There's still not a lot of data.
Correct.
And so the answer is really, really complex. I think there's some other theories floating around that I find very interesting about the social media aspect of it,
absolutely.
The kind of a rise in narcissism,
yes.
our obsession with fame in this country, and that outliers that sort of feel like they're drifting and have no other way of feeling powerful in the world, you know, see this as a way to do that.
Well, it brings to mind the Charleston shooting at the church, and that young man had really been radicalized by spending a lot of time online looking at white supremacist websites and the like. So, yeah, it's a really complicated recipe, I think. You know, we in our business have failed at trying to create a profile. You know, if I'm dealing as a forensic psychologist with, say, sex offenders, it's much easier for me to generate a profile than with these
yeah.
folks. And because it's sort of all over the map, and you know, some of the data I've seen suggests that those of us in this field do a pretty bad job of predicting who is going to be the next shooter. What does this person look like? I mean, there's some gross qualities, but certainly it's a very mixed picture. Would you agree with that? And just in terms of how you see things in your work,
it is. And I think. We're still really getting our arms around it. And so it's, you know, because it's still such a relatively new phenomenon, and sort of analyzing it has been a low priority. There's not been a lot of money thrown at that.
Right.
So in some ways it's like, how do you describe an elephant? Well, if you have five people in a room looking at the elephant, one's going to say, well, it's got this long trunk, and the other person is going to say it has this, you know, really huge foot. And that's what we're looking at right now, is that we've got the profile might be, you know, somebody that's has mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia. Somebody else might say, you know, it's a teenager that's been bullied. Somebody else might say it's somebody that has, you know, spent too much time gaming and looking at violent images, or has been influenced by bloggers. So there's so many different answers to that. And of course, if we look at adolescents and school shooters, or we look at folks that go into public places that are largely male, you know, 25 to 40, then if we look at males that go into workplaces, the issues are very, very different, and then the profile is different.
Yeah. You know, I found this fascinating that I saw a recent study that said, contrary to this image of this sort of marauding loner, that social relationships are a better predictor. Then in this study, they
yes.
found that 85% of the shootings that they looked at occurred within a social network. In other words, relatives, friends, enemies, acquaintances, not some lone psychopath. And so, again, it's as with sexual assault. We talk about most of them are known to the perpetrators are known to the victim. And here we have shootings where in 85%, at least in this one study, they are it's in within a social network, which, you know, again, that the media presents this as these lone wolves out there just randomly shooting people, and it's just not the case.
No. No, it's very complex.
Yeah.
Very complex. And, you know, threat assessment is, you know, I think the field is growing, but faster, but it's not fast enough, because the shootings are happening at such an alarming rate. And we just don't have the systems in place yet.
Well, and this, you and I have talked about this whole notion of contagion, where there starts to be sort of a copycat phenomenon where,
yes.
you know, I heard about it. That's pretty cool. I want to be famous. You know, let me go shoot somebody. And I really think that accounts for some of the apparent increase is the contagion effect.
Well, Well, yeah, and if we look at one of the theories that many of the mass shooters are seeking this kind of fame and attention, that and they see the kind of attention that was given. I think, you know, many mass shooters have in their writings have talked about, you know, looking at the Columbine shooters as you know, exemplars.
Is there role models?
And when we look at the killing of the journalist Allison Parker and her cameraman in Roanoke, you know, he actually used the social media to upload the killing to Twitter and Facebook. So the technology has made it so much easier, and there's this underlying attention-seeking kind of narcissism.
Yes.
So they see, and then if somebody is sort of sitting there, feeling very disgruntled, feeling very disempowered, seeing the attention that these folks are garnering, that there is this kind of copycat response.
Great. Well, gosh, Mary, I feel like we could talk forever, but our time is just about up. I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise. My guest this morning has been Mary Vandeventer, who's a clinical social worker in Northern Virginia, and we've been talking about workplace violence and critical incident debriefing. Mary, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. I know our listeners really enjoyed your comments today, so maybe we can get you back on here sometime.
You're very welcome.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, so we're going to wrap up for today. Please stay tuned for Straight Talk with Andra Hakes coming up right now at the top of the hour. And this is your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. I will be here next week at 9 o'clock, so please join us. Have a good week, and take care. Thank you.